morning.
So you do get up. I was beginning to think perhaps you worked in bed like Marcel Proust.
Who's he?
Hey, it's the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode number 47, and we're saying hello to the long goodbye. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet, and all the little internets. You're listening to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 47. I'm Jeff.
I'm Dave Costel.
Nope. I'm Jeff Rollins. First, I go first.
I'm Dave Costel.
I'm Chris Evangelista.
See how it is when we all take turns? It's nice.
Yeah, play nice, Dave.
Sorry, I had a little too much to drink because it's right. So early in the evening.
Dave, today's afternoon. The Super Bowl, and Dave loves sports.
Yes,
so.
We've been in the studio punching holes through footballs because we're so excited. But we're here to talk about movies because that's what we do on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. We are a movie podcast, and we talk about new movies, old movies, movies that haven't been made yet,
movies
that will never be made, snuff movies. Yeah. You know, live birthing movies.
Yeah, anything. We'll talk about anything. Car crash videos.
We love them. We love movies. So what are we talking about this week? What's new in the world of movies?
Well, the biggest bit of movie news involves the Ghostbusters reboot, I would say.
Ooh.
Wait, who are you going to call?
Well, I won't be calling you anytime soon because I hate your guts. We're
So it's an all-female Ghostbusters cast.
Right, yeah. So Paul Feig, is that how you say the name?
Feig Newton.
Yeah, Paul Feig, he's rebooting Ghostbusters, which I'm fine with. If you have to do another Ghostbusters film, I'd rather it be done this way, just because it's not going to be the same. I mean, Harold Ramis is dead.
Yes.
And the other Ghostbusters are all pretty old and slow now.
Bill Murray couldn't be bothered.
Right, so, I mean, this is... Obviously, they're going to make a Ghostbusters movie no matter what. So this seems like a good way to do it.
Yeah, they announced earlier last year in 2014 that if they were going to do a Ghostbusters remake, it would be a female-centric cast.
Which I think is cool.
I think it's the best way to go.
Yeah, instead of just trying to be like, you know, oh, here's the new Dan Aykroyd, you know, it's at least
original,
right?
For lack of a better word, it's the only original aspect of doing another reboot of a movie that really doesn't need a reboot in the first place.
No.
But if you're going to do it, I have no problem, and it's the most interesting way that
it
you
is.
Could possibly reboot this. I'm going to call it a franchise, even though that second one I'd rather not acknowledge.
I feel like the second one gets a bad.
It wasn't
rap bad,
except they forgot to put any jokes in it.
But there's a river of slime.
There sure is.
There is, and yeah. But and for some reason, crybaby boys out there aren't too happy about this idea. I don't know why. I honestly couldn't think of a single reason why you'd be so upset over the Ghostbusters being women.
Well, maybe if you were, you know, a meminist,
yeah, oh,
you would understand,
or
Chris.
A Mennonite.
Just fucking.
No, that's a different group.
They don't like female Ghostbusters either, but for different reasons. But yeah, so
do you think the secretary will be a sexy man?
I hope so.
Like Neil Patrick Harris?
Yes.
just a shirtless man who's wearing a bow tie.
Yeah, he's dressed like a Chippendale dancer. So there was a lot of fun fan casting going on, like who you would want to be as the female Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. But we can put all that fan casting to bed because this week – it was announced who the real cast is. And
what type of bed would you put them in? A Murphy bed?
I'd probably
fold them up into the wall.
I'd probably put it in the race car bed. The bed looks like a race car.
I like it. Yeah. Dave, what's your take? What's your hot take?
What's your favorite bed?
A ghost bed.
All right.
Because it's the Ghostbusters.
Oh, all right.
Not even a thing.
That's a coffin.
Oh, okay. Glad you cleared that up.
Yeah, all right. That was a good save. So, yeah, here are the official Ghostbuster females. It is
Whoopi Goldberg.
Barbra Streisand.
No, these are both wrong. Both of you are incorrect. So, first and foremost, Melissa McCarthy.
Elle Fanning.
You're not helping.
No.
Melissa McCarthy, which pretty much everyone assumed was going to be in this.
Yeah.
Kristen Wiig.
Also, everyone assumed.
Yeah, those are like Paul Feig's go-to. Right,
yeah. Go-to ladies.
Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones. And Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones are, of course, both on Saturday Night Live. which I haven't watched in decades, so I'm not familiar with their work.
See, there's no need to watch it, but Dave, you're our SNL expert. You watch it every week.
Yes. Dave TiVos it. And
I watch it Saturday morning. Or no, Sunday morning. Sorry.
You get the advanced copy of the live show.
Dave is Starman.
It's like early edition, but with Saturday Night Live. The tape lands on his doorstep.
So, Dave, will you please weigh in on Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones? Are they funny women?
Are they equipped to bust ghosts?
Kate McKinnon is fucking hilarious. Besides Cecily Strong, which I was really hoping she would be in this.
Cecily Strong is fantastic.
I hear there's rumors she might play some sort of villain in it still. So
hopefully it's Viggo the Carpathian.
Yes.
There's a big painting of her, apparently.
I wonder who she could be.
Comes to life. But Leslie Jones is not good. She's not... She doesn't really add anything to the show. It seems like she's always just like standing in the background and will have like one or two lines. And even just having one line, she's just like not built for live sketch comedy.
Even not watching the show, I've heard of Kate McKinnon, but I've never heard the name Leslie Jones until this like happened. So I was like, who is that?
I saw the first episode Leslie Jones was on, and she was hired after SNL was taken to task for having zero black cast members.
And rightfully so.
And so, you know, naturally everyone that just has a general self-loathing was up in arms that they hired a black woman in response to this criticism.
Right.
So I checked it out. I wanted to see, all right, let's see who this new cast member is. And the only thing I saw her on was a segment in Weekend Update. And it was the one time I laughed the entire episode. But I see what you're saying. She wasn't really doing a live sketch comedy type routine. It was more of a stand-up routine. And I thought, I would love to see this woman do stand-up because she was animated. She was funny. She was saying funny things, but it was not scripted and it was not sketch comedy.
Yeah, she has like a Weekend Update character who is fairly funny. But when she's in sketches, she just doesn't fit in. Like
Dave, you were saying like she flubs her lines
She never hits her line right. It's always wrong, and you could always tell she's like reading the cue card like over someone's shoulder. So it's very distracting.
Fortunately, with a movie, that's impossible.
Maybe she's just not like as good as like live improv.
I'm actually kind of interested to see.
Oh, I'm very interested. What about Kate McKinnon? What's she known for on
SNL? She does an amazing Angela Merkel impression, the German chancellor.
Oh, okay.
So she's always on Weekend Update doing that. But she's like, I don't know. I don't know what her staple bit is because...
Would she be an Egon or a Peter Venkman?
Right.
I would have had to have seen the Ghostbusters before to answer that question. No, I'm just kidding.
Dave, well, I think Chris and I'll take it from here.
I'm going to put my brass knuckles on and punch you in the kisser.
An Egon, yeah, definitely.
She's
but
an Egon?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't see them emulating the characters
I doubt they'll do that, but who knows?
I know, I know.
I just see them building characters around these already established personalities.
Right.
Which Kate McKinnon has a bizarre fucking... like sense of anything, so I have no idea what kind of character they'll build her around. Her,
do you think they'll build these characters around the original Ghostbusters cartoon from the 70s where there was a giant ape?
I hope so.
Will Kristen Wiig be the giant ape that wears a trench coat and a hat?
I'm just wondering if Slimer will be a girl now.
That's a ridiculous question.
He'll have a little slime wig.
Wow.
Boy, if they put Slimer in a dress, then I'd have a real problem with this movie. But as it stands, I'm excited about this Ghostbusters, even though my excitement is lukewarm in general, just on the basic principle of rebooting existing popular franchises.
I mean,
I could see this being funny, though. Like, for some reason,
I want it to be fun. I'm not that blown away by this cast. And like I said, I love the idea of an all-female Ghostbusters film. I'm not that impressed with this cast. I mean... Kristen Wiig, I like, but Melissa McCarthy is just so fucking obvious. Just like, it's like a given that she'd be in this. And like we've said before, I hope she plays the most competent member of the Ghostbusters.
I was hoping for her to be the Brainiac Egon character.
That's what
I want. Just to play against type and, you know, just be generally funny that straight man role.
Like, yeah, I don't want her to have I don't want her character to fall down once in this film. I just don't want that.
Oh, boy, do I not want that at all.
I don't know. I see Kristen Wiig more as, like, the Bill Murray.
I just feel like she's going to be the lead of the film because she's out of this cast, she's the biggest actress.
Yeah.
And, like, Peter Venkman is obviously really the lead of Ghostbusters. Yeah. So, But I don't know. I was saying, like, I wish they'd also cast a non-comedian. Like, I feel like this it's all comedians.
Kind of like Ernie Hudson was the original.
Like I felt like Emma Stone would be, like, a good addition to this. Because she can be funny, but she's not a comedian. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought that would be an interesting... But I don't know, you know?
Yeah, she would have been in my dream cast.
Right.
Yeah, she's really the only person I can think of that I would have really liked in this.
I get, yeah.
Did you have any, like, maybe Amy Adams?
I mean,
Adams would have been nice.
Just in general, or just, I mean, I'm always pulling for, like, Amy Poehler to be in more things.
Would have been a welcome addition.
Because I think she's really talented, and I think she gets stuck in really shitty movies, and mm-hmm. I feel like it'd be good if she got into, like, a good film for
Tina Fey was on a lot of people's list, but that's another obvious casting choice, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, her and Amy Poehler, they're, like, SNL alums, so it still fits that, you know, formula.
Yeah. So, I mean, but it's like, again, it's too early to tell. Who knows? I mean, yeah.
Hopefully there's nothing formulaic about this movie. I think Paul Feig was quoted as saying he would like to make this a scarier Ghostbusters, which I'm all for. As much as you can veer away from the original, I'm all for. I love it.
There was actually an interesting bit when the news broke. Hit Fix had a breaking thing, and the studio actually made them take it down, which means it probably is going to happen where in the original Ghostbusters, it's the character of Walter Peck, played mm-hmm. by William Atherton, who excelled at playing jerks. And there's a character based on that character in the script for this, and they want Bill Murray to play that part, mm-hmm. which I think is actually kind of fucking interesting. And I don't know.
Interesting.
I'd love to see Bill Murray in that opposite sort of. He's like the jerk character.
Yeah.
He's the villain, basically, in this Ghostbusters reboot.
It's going to fuck up the canon, though, man.
That rich Ghostbusters mythology we've all come to write about for years.
Just stop.
This is really interesting. I heard that the entire movie is going to be filmed found footage FaceTime from an iMac. So that someone's carrying around for the whole movie.
Will there be GoPros on people's heads?
So let me get this straight. Somebody's carrying an iMac around?
Backwards. They're showing it to everybody.
The whole computer.
Yeah, that's their proton pack. They wear it backwards. That seems like a cumbersome idea.
Mm. So you're just getting a shot of their back the whole movie.
Wow.
Boy, does that stink.
I can't wait to see that.
Well, any other thoughts on Ghostbusters, or can we move on?
No,
you know where there were some spooky ghosts? At the Sundance Film Festival.
Nice segue, Dave.
Perfect.
Seriously, I love it. Did you just fill that up with gas, or is that electric?
I just did a wheelie, but you couldn't tell because there's only...
Dave just got a new position as a mall cop, and he's showing off his Segway and segueing into this Sundance Film Festival topic.
It's Costell's cake.
Okay.
So, yeah, Sundance happened all last week. We weren't there, obviously, because we weren't. So.
Yep. We couldn't afford tickets, nor did we have press credentials to get in.
Yeah, no one pays us to do this, so we couldn't go.
We had the press credentials and the money. We just didn't want to go.
Yeah, just total jerks. Sorry.
Don't blow it.
So, there's a lot of buzz for certain films. The
B movie. There's a lot of buzz.
On
this fucking joke.
Barry the B. We all want to know what he's been up to. B movie 2 hits theaters this year. Picked up at Sundance Film Festival.
Who saw that coming? So the big winner at Sundance was Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which won both the.
You were in that?
Yeah, I was. I was.
No,
in
not,
it.
Not him. Not him. That's the full title.
Oh, right. The title is Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Right. Correct. Well, I'm the Dying Girl in the film.
You're really asking me to away any type of disbelief.
Yep, it's a movie. Movies are magic. So that won the Audience Award and the Judges Award, whatever the hell it's called there.
Well, there's 1,400 awards handed out at Sundance. Every audience member gets to present a single award. This is Timothy's favorite film award.
It's like grade school where everyone gets like a good job award. You tried. So that film, it's based on a book. And it's about two friends who make movies, and they form a bond with a girl who's dying. I mean, it sounds like...
At the behest of the Me character's mother.
Right. And it sounds like maudlin...
I don't think this sounds good at all, but all I know is by what you just said.
Right. But, like, yeah, the plot sounds shitty.
Is it like Twee? Does it have, like, a Juno thing going on?
It sounded like it.
See, yeah. But then all the buzz, again, there's that word, were... It was,
hype.
I would say 90% was really positive. Like, people came out of it saying, like, they thought it was going to be just like pappy maudlin crap.
And these are critics.
That, right.
Yeah.
And they came out and said like, oh, that's actually, it's better than it should be.
Crickets. They're crickets.
Oh.
No. No, I don't think so.
Boy, what a stupid thing to say.
So what specific, was there one movie that piqued your interest at Sundance?
The one, the biggest one for me is The Witch, which was was picked up by our favorite company, A24 Films, who they release great movies in a terrible way.
Yeah, they have a really methodic release schedule. I don't understand it. It's clearly understood by somebody higher up.
Yeah.
But yeah, they released some interesting and daring films.
Right.
I'm even going to include Kevin Smith's Tusk last year as a risky gamble that they took, even though it didn't pay off. That's a strange film, and for a studio to, you know, release that wide is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, like last year alone, they released Under the Skin was them, Most Violent Year, which they released every week for 2 months somehow.
Very strange.
They still are.
Yeah, it's last Friday it finally came out everywhere. So they're a great company, but I just hope they release this.
Tell us about the movie, The Witch.
Basically, it takes place in New England in 1630, and it's about this family of devout Christians. They're so devout that their Christian community actually kicked them out of the community.
Oh, it's the story of America.
Yeah, they're too hardcore even for the hardcore Christians. So they're living in the woods basically alone, and they have a newborn baby, and the baby disappears, and they believe a witch stole the baby. And, you know, there's not a lot of info because critics don't want to give everything away, but just from the descriptions, it just sounds really cool and creepy.
From what I read, and this might be a spoiler, at the end, there's a twist where it's actually Hitch from the film Hitch that stole the baby. It's Will Smith's character, Hitch.
I don't think anyone saw that coming.
Mm. I read it. There's a rather disturbing opening scene with the baby.
Yes, there
and
is.
That really kind of made me really interested in it.
Right. I mean, and there's a goat in the film, and the goat is named Black Phillip. Just everything I hear about the movie, that's really true. That's the goat's name.
Very bizarre.
And like just like every bit of info I hear about this movie just sounds just really cool, and just, it sounds creepy and interesting. And I love period horror movies, horror movies that are set in a certain time.
It adds an extra element,
right.
That normally would have, you know, if this was set in present day, who cares,
right? And I mean, yeah, the reviews for this have been almost – I don't think I've seen one negative review of this film. The director won the directing award there.
Nice.
Robert Eggers is his name, and this is his first film, I think. He's like a photographer, but this is like his first narrative film.
All right.
Did you have one?
I did. Another film that's getting critical praise that did that premiered at Sundance, and I think it was purchased. I'm not sure. Is a film called Tangerine.
Yes.
Yeah, it was purchased.
Okay. Do you know who purchased it?
I'll tell you. Once
it was Magnolia. Me.
Who?
Magnolia.
Oh, excellent. So this will come out.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Definitely.
So Tangerine is about a prostitute who goes through Hollywood on Christmas Eve searching for this pimp who, you know, spurned her advances, broke her heart, so to speak.
Wow, sounds like a feel-good film.
It sounds great, and it's a drama, and but it's directed by a guy named Sean Baker.
Isn't this the one that was shot on, like, iPhones?
It is.
So, yeah, when I heard that, I said, I don't ever want to fucking see this.
But when you hear that synopsis, does that not sound appropriate?
That does. It sounds interesting.
They're stealing the Ghostbusters IMAX thing? Damn it.
He also did a film called Starlet, which I never saw. And he did an episode of Greg the Bunny.
Oh, remember that show?
That show nobody wanted to watch.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, boy. It's not good.
It had like a puppet.
Yeah.
We
don't even need to talk about Greg the Bunny.
That sucks all the life.
Yeah.
What about
I kind of avoided reading too much about Tangerine because I saw some stills of it, and I was like, this looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
So and then the iPhone thing turned me off of it, and then I was like, I don't want to read about this.
It turned me off, too. And then I read the synopsis after I heard everybody praising it. I was like, you know what? This is so appropriate to film this with an iPhone 5 because that's what they filmed it with.
Is the soundtrack done by Tangerine Dream?
I hope so. Or Blood Orange, which is sort of like a tangerine.
Right.
But not as delicious.
No, not as dreamy.
She uses Vaseline.
No.
Different song.
Oh, it is?
So, no, Dave.
Nope.
What's yours?
Well, my number one movie at Sundance was Mistress America, but in the interest of keeping my nose unbroken, I won't talk about that right
Please
now.
Please don't.
I want to see that.
That's by Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, it's
right?
the I almost called her Frances Ha, but Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach.
I love Greta Gerwig. So.
But there's a movie by the guy who directed Room 237.
Yeah.
Not 273. That insane batshit documentary about The Shining that made no sense. He has a movie called The Nightmare, which is a documentary following eight people who suffer from sleep paralysis.
Yes.
Which is actually something that I get every now and then. I don't suffer from it. I get it like two or three times a year. But after reading the descriptions of this movie, I suffer from a very light case of it. Because apparently there's something known as the intruder, where while this is happening to you, sleep paralysis is basically like you're asleep, but you wake up and you can like see around you, but you can't move.
It's like being in a coma, but conscious.
It fucking sucks. But apparently these people start to feel a presence in the room with them. And it will sometimes like walk around and crawl on them and stuff. So the documentary,
some more crazy people, essentially.
A part of me, like when I read about that, I was like, I feel like these people are making that up.
Yes, this is a director who seems to excel in people making things up.
Like sleep paralysis is real. I don't doubt that, but
it is. Yeah, no, that's the real part.
But the extent that this movie is presenting it makes me feel like these are just liars.
And it's funny you say that because Mike D'Angelo, who reviewed it for The Dissolve, said the same thing because he gets it too, and he was like, he also had no idea that part of it happened. So maybe it is made up because.
Because, I mean, like, Room 237, that film, it wasn't really about the theories. It was about, look at how crazy these people are. Like, that's what the hook of that film was. And I feel like that's what he's doing again with this.
But apparently this uses, like, really cool visuals to recreate these things that are apparently pretty terrifying. Like, the movie's supposed to be, like, a scary documentary.
Oh, I'm all about a scary documentary.
And that's what has me, like...
The thing with Room 237 that turned me off was just the... There was no believability to what these lunatics were saying, and I feel like I'm going to have that same reaction to these crazy folks.
Yeah, it's hard for me to watch documentaries when the
subjects are lying.
Yeah, when they're just batshit, and I'm just like, just stop.
There's no empathizing. With
it's
crazy.
Hard.
Like
and 237 kept using terrible clips from that Shining movie. Ugh. Sorry. Those are our three. I mean, I have a list of 17 films from Sundance.
Let's go through them one by one.
But, in alphabetical order.
The way it turned out last year was that most of the movies we raved about throughout the year premiered at Sundance.
Yeah.
Sundance is, it's a champion of independent films.
Right.
A lot of them get purchased at Sundance. Most films get purchased at Sundance.
Yeah.
What's cool, though, now is we don't have to watch the shit. Like if we the festival we go to after this that will have all the same movies at it, we can just see all these movies.
Right. Yeah, this is a nice filter that we don't have to endure the garbage that isn't worthy of
some
purchase.
Of those critics see like 45 movies in 6 days, which would put me in a coma.
For the Philadelphia Film Festival, I saw something around 12 films in 5 days.
How many did you do back to back?
And I would do two back to back at a time just because of the way the schedule worked.
Yeah.
And that was a lot.
Yeah.
That was daunting.
How many did you do ass to ass?
Not a one. Not a one.
All right. I'm just always looking for some ass to ass.
No, that's fine. Who isn't?
Is there some over there? Have you checked in the corner over there?
Maybe when we go to break.
Check in the hutch and the hitch.
Okay, well, we should go to break and check it out.
Right. And then we'll check out some ass to ass during the break, and then we'll come back and. Continue our director series
on Robert Altman.
That's right.
And stay tuned for the new commercial that we just recorded. Oh, wait, no, it's the same old one.
Oh.
Yep. We're going to run this commercial into the dirt and deeper.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
Whoa.
We're back.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Saying goodbye to all those horses.
Yeah. And we're all putting lipstick on one another.
Yes. Tucking it in.
In anticipation for our long goodbye discussion.
It's very appropriate.
So, yeah, this is a continuation of our director series on Robert Altman.
Yes.
And
Altman.
No, it's Robert Altman.
Yeah, let's not be silly.
And I think I have a piece of production to play before we get into this.
I hope so.
It's the Cut Print Film Director Series.
Action.
Directors! Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
I love the live laugh you can hear in the
time. It's my wheeze. As I suck on my inhaler.
Yes. Here, suck on this. It's a Luden's
Whoa!
Hey, everybody.
Hey, now.
You're getting rowdy here.
Literally, you're not getting ready to read a synopsis or anything.
No, I am. That's the problem. Hang on. Let me put a lasso around myself and restrain things here.
What is The Long Goodbye about?
Well, The Long Goodbye, which came out in 1973, stars Elliot Gould, Sterling Hayden, who was in a previous episode of our director series in Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, Nina Van Pallant, Henry Gibson, Mark Rydell, and the star of the film, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, as a man with a mustache.
And it's a film noir, sort of, directed by Robert Altman. And here's how
it's
the plot
more like
goes.
A surf noir.
Yeah, it's a surf noir. It sure is. Applying his deconstructive eye to the film noir tradition, Robert Altman updated Raymond Chandler in his 1973 version of Chandler's novel, The Long Goodbye. Smart-ass, cat-loving, private-eye Philip Marlowe, played by Elliot Gould, is certain that his friend Terry Lennox, played by former baseball player Jim Bouton, isn't a wife killer, even after the cops throw Marlowe in jail for not cooperating with their investigation into Lennox's subsequent disappearance. Once he gets out of jail, Marlowe starts to conduct his own search when he discovers that mysterious blonde Eileen Wade, who hired him to find her alcoholic novelist husband Roger, played by Sterling Hayden, lives on the same Malibu street as the absent Lennox and his deceased spouse. As numerous variations of the title song play in unexpected places, Marlowe encounters a shady doctor, a bottle-wielding gangster, and a guard aping Barbara Stanwyck, among other former Hollywood A-listers, before heading to Mexico to stumble onto the truth once and for all. And that's the plot in a nutshell.
Yeah. And there's the part where they all take their clothes off. Let's take our clothes off.
Yeah. I want to apologize. Let me take all my clothes off. So this film, immediately after watching it, I thought, well, I think I just saw something like this.
Yeah.
And it was called Inherent Vice. Dave, you wanted to take Paul Thomas Anderson to task on this?
Yeah, I was going to save this for later, but...
Well, we can save it for later. It was at the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, along with
this plot for murder of my own family.
It's very immediate.
Whoa! This is a dark episode. I was not expecting that final part there.
From the first scene, you realize that this is Inherent Vice is very much influenced by this.
See, I'm a little more forgiving just because I'm used to that now with Paul Thomas. Paul Thomas Anderson is like, he's the highbrow Quentin Tarantino.
He's also very much into aping Robert Altman.
Right, he loves Robert Altman stuff.
But this bugged me a little more because the story elements were so similar.
But like, you can't really blame that on Paul Thomas Anderson.
You can blame Thomas Pynchon because he wrote the source material for Inherent Vice.
Yeah, and I kind of felt like after watching The Long Goodbye that Pynchon did the same thing, got high, and then just banged out 500 pages and called it a masterpiece.
Probably. But
it's likely.
And totally, Inherent Vice is different because it's a little more positive than this, I would say.
Yes.
But it hits similar beats, and And then the way Paul Thomas Anderson based, like, his characters look like the characters in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from Doc, who doesn't look like Philip Marlowe.
He doesn't look like Philip Marlowe, but come on, he's Philip
acts
Marlowe.
Exactly. Like, everything well, said under his breath in the same manner that it is in Inherent, not that it I, is in The Long Goodbye.
I actually, like, Elliot Gould's performance in this, which I loved, it reminded me of another Paul Thomas Anderson. It actually reminded me more of Joaquin Phoenix's performance in The Master. It's that sort of shambling,
a drifting type character.
And he's always like smoking. And he even does this thing. There's a scene where Philip Marlowe, he puts his hand on his hips and he does it like really high up.
Yeah.
And Joaquin Phoenix does that same thing in The Master. Yeah. That always like struck me as really weird.
It's this praying mantis type stance.
Yeah, because like when I put my hands on my my woman-like hips, they're not that high up, but they both do that where it's just like it's like almost at their like armpits. It's like so like they're doing a chicken wing sort of thing.
So I mean, anybody who's anybody knows that Paul Thomas Anderson is in creative debt to Robert Altman.
Right.
So that's just a few examples.
Martin Short looks exactly like the doctor in this film.
Yeah, that is. And even that like plot where it's the, you know, the insane asylum.
Yep.
And the,
Okay, so
but it's kind of cool at the same time.
No, I loved it. Yeah. I love when new directors wink at old masterpieces, even if it's, you know, derivative at times.
Yeah.
But does it diminish Paul Thomas Anderson's work a little bit?
I don't think so, because I think I feel like all artists are inspired by other artists. That's just how it works. And there's that like that saying where it's
We're all inspired. It all goes back to the cave of forgotten dreams.
It's like it's good artists borrow, great artists steal. That's the saying. And I feel like, you know, you have to be inspired by other things. You know?
And it's different. It's even different in tone. Like you said, Inherent Vice isn't as dark as The Long Goodbye. And it's also not as cynical, because this is a very cynical movie.
Oh, yeah.
But whereas Robert Altman was interested in deconstructing and tearing down old Hollywood legends and ideas and constructs, Paul Thomas Anderson is kind of paying homage to, you know, the films of the 70s. And so that's why that tone is different, and that's why I don't have a problem with Anderson.
It is interesting to say that, like, the way Altman is deconstructing, like, the Philip Marlowe movies, but then Anderson is building the like these Altman movies back up.
Yeah, he's
like
building the myth of Altman.
Right.
It's like it peaked, and now they're trying, like,
it's fascinating,
trying to buttress that the genius.
Yeah,
which is cool.
Yeah.
It is, and that is the specific reason why I think Paul Thomas Anderson is one of the best living directors.
Oh no, yeah, he's still my. And I think of Nikolai Winding Refn. I don't know how
he's
you say that guy.
He's an up and coming.
Yeah, and he mimics Kubrick like to a T. So whenever I see that, I'm like, you know, this is good, but it's just Kubrick light, where Paul Thomas Anderson does is a completely different thing. So this is different than just
mimicking.
Yeah.
So barring all that, now that that is out of the way,
yes,
let's go to the bar.
Yeah,
since we're barring it all.
I'm glad we got that done.
Here, I put 245-pound plates on this bar. I want you to put it up over your head. All right, so now that all the Foley work's done,
yes,
I want to talk about the opening of The Long Goodbye, where for 20 minutes, Elliot Gould's Philip Marlowe talks to himself without moving his mouth and tries to feed his cat.
Man, all right, so
what did everybody think of this?
What did you call it, Les? ADR?
It's additional dialogue. It's like dialogue added later. And,
okay.
I thought it was amusing. I like it in theory, but
this stinks,
I'm
right?
already sick of Altman's thing where he does it in all his fucking movies, where his characters just wander around mutter. And I was saying as a joke, and I almost want to do this, where I want to make a super cut video of all of Robert Altman's characters in movies just walking around muttering to themselves. And it's just, it bugs the shit out of me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm going to tip my hat here for the rest of the episode. This is the one thing I did not like about this movie.
Right.
Whereas in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, they have a lot of overlapping dialogue.
Right.
There's none of that here, but you do get this Philip Marlowe talking to himself, but as though he's talking to other people.
I mean, I feel like
they're interacting with him, but he's not really saying anything to them. He's just thinking things. But you hear this loud, and it's definitely off-putting. It's so loud.
It's off the mix, too.
Yeah.
It's louder than anything else.
Out of it. It's right into the microphone. What are you?
Yeah, it's not good.
Which makes you think, like, is Philip Marlowe saying any of that stuff?
I mean, like, I feel like it's basically Altman's thing is it's like internal monologue just vocalized.
Yeah.
And I actually feel like it, in theory, this works for this character because he's supposed to be sort of like a lunatic, basically. But it's just, it's so fucking distracting.
Yeah, that's the word, distracting. Right. Because you're right. In theory, this idea should work.
Right.
But this is the one time, I think, in this movie where Altman's creativity gets the better of him, and he just doesn't execute it well. Like you said, the mix is off, so Gould, his voice is way up in the front. Right. And my wife was like, what is happening? Is there something wrong with our television?
Yeah, I was like, do you think it was a technological restraint, too? Because Altman moves the camera like nobody else at this time did.
His camera never sits still. There's no static shots in this film.
Yeah, but it's beautiful camera.
There's no wireless mics or anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. So to get that dialogue.
He was trying to do something that was just impossible to do at the time. So he did his best, and it wasn't great. But so you get this whole scene with Detective Private Eye Philip Marlowe trying to feed his cat.
Right.
And I think the first time somebody even says anything to him is 10 minutes into the film, where one of his neighbors tells him, hey, can you pick up some brownie mix? And he says, yeah, sure.
He's like, what kind of brownie mix?
Yeah, and so they tell him to pick up, it's this commune of hippie women that teach yoga.
They're always topless.
yeah, they're constantly topless. And they ask him to pick up brownie mix. And he said, yeah, sure. And I tell him, you're the nicest neighbor we've ever had. And he says, oh, of course I'm nice. I'm a private eye. And that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, like, why is he saying that?
But I really like that line. I just wish it was said through his own lips on screen.
He has a lot of these little quips that are just hilarious. Yeah. Like, will make you just howl.
It's a very funny movie in general. I mean,
it really is. Even though it's so cynical and so, it's this cutting satire of not only film noir from the 50s, but also just Hollywood in general. It's one of the best anti-Hollywood movies that isn't about actors and actresses that I've ever seen. But we can get into that. Yeah. But
from a performance level, the dubbing aside, what did you guys think of Elliot Gould in the film?
He's class great. Act.
I'm not like familiar with his work. I know Elliot Gould mostly from fucking like Friends, where he's like Ross's dad. But he's so good in this movie that it makes me want to like go seek out his other films.
Yeah, he's fantastic in this.
And he wasn't in a lot though, right?
He was. He has such an immense filmography, but it's all these bit parts because. As his star was rising, he got heavily into drugs and just became this cantankerous jerk that nobody would work with for a while until Altman picked him up for MASH.
He was making a film. He was making a film with Peter Bogdanovich called What's Up, Doc? And his behavior was so erratic on the set, they fired him and replaced him with Ryan O'Neill, who was in our previous film.
Yeah.
And, so for like, I think 2 years, he was blacklisted. No one would hire him. And Altman said, like, I want him for this movie. And this was sort of like his big comeback film.
Yeah. This and MASH.
Yeah.
Because he played Trapper John in MASH.
He played Trapper Keeper.
Yeah. he was the Panther Trapper Keeper.
But it's a great performance. And I love the like the juxtaposition because basically everyone in this film, they're in the 70s, but Marlowe is from like the 50s still.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I had that in my notes. Yeah. It's fucking great.
Like the one thing he does in this film that affected me a lot, he smokes this entire film and it made me want to start smoking cigarettes again.
He might as well have been lighting one cigarette off the previous one.
I love there's a great like character tick he has where he's constantly lighting matches off of anything. Just anything nearby, he could light it off like anything.
He's like Ed Harris in Creepshow where he's lighting matches off the wall.
Yeah.
He's lighting it off his shoulder.
And that's even like a callback to the older cinema because those matches, they weren't around in the 70s.
I mean, they were not as widely used. Anywhere. Yeah, and It's a contrast because even in the 70s, California was health nut crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys noticed, but no one else in the movie smokes. He's the only character who smokes the entire film. And it's this like clash where everyone in California is trying to be healthy and modern. And even his car is like from the 50s.
Yeah. Did any of you watch the DVD extra Rip Van Marlowe?
I read like a breakdown. I didn't watch it.
Okay. Because that's in there.
Right.
And it's available on YouTube. But yeah, it came with the DVD.
Can we play it right now?
No, we can't. That's illegal. That'd be a copyright infringement. But yeah, they mentioned that, and it's called Rip Van Marlow because he's literally yanked out of the 50s, plopped into the 70s, and he's just this – he's so laid back about – he's got this laissez-faire attitude about everything, and he puts himself, much like Doc Sportello in Inherent Vice, he puts himself in these incredibly dangerous situations in search of the truth. And originally, in the original story, he's pretty much the cleanest person in the film as far as the moral compass goes.
Right. This was inspired by the Raymond Chandler novel.
Right. Unlike but the ending of this film where he commits murder.
Right.
But so he and Doc Sportello have that in common, whereas Doc is completely clean. Marlow in this film, he's clean except for that one murder at the end.
And he has like a... Because you said he's so laid back. He even has like a catchphrase where he's always just like, it's okay with me. He just says that like,
I love it.
To everyone.
I love it. It goes back to the Elliot Gould performance. He's almost asleep.
Yeah.
He might as well be getting ready for a nap in every single scene. It's great.
He is very like just... Because he doesn't sleep. He wakes up in the opening scene, so I guess he doesn't sleep the whole movie.
You never see him.
It's a cool character. I don't mean cool as in, like, look at how cool he is. He's just, like, he's just there.
He's calm.
Like, he's in scenes where, I think the only time he reacts is when the woman gets the bottle smashed on her face. Yeah. But even at the end where he's with those same characters and they're all acting like fucking lunatics, he's just like, he's just standing. He doesn't seem care at all.
Yeah, he's very passive.
Yeah.
Things just happen to him. He's not actively
He's very passive until the very end where it's like, never mind.
Yeah. So what happens is after he feeds his cat, after the 20-minute intro,
he goes to buy Curry Brand cat food, which he says the name 40 times.
Yeah. And I looked it up. Not a real cat food company, so I don't know what that was about.
And I love that he tries to fool the cat by putting it in. He can't get the right brand, so he puts a different brand in the right brand's can because he really wants to impress his cat, and the cat does not fall for it.
So once he fails in feeding the cat, he gets a ring on the phone from his buddy.
Right.
Terry.
Terry Lennox. And Terry.
Owen Wilson.
No, not Owen Wilson, but
not?
Might as well be.
Yeah.
Terry Lennox, played by I don't have the man's name. Jim Bouton.
Okay.
A former baseball player who has a desperate need for a ride to Mexico.
Yeah, Tijuana.
And Marlo doesn't ask any questions because they're buddies, but Terry Lennox tells him, you know, my wife, she's got me in all sorts of trouble, so I need a ride to Tijuana. So Marlo takes him to Tijuana, and when he comes home the next morning, two detectives are there, and they want to know, where's Terry Lennox? Because he killed his wife.
Right.
And Marlo won't give them any information, so he gets put in jail for 3 days, is it?
Yeah, it's 3 days.
3 days in the clink.
There's a great, weird interrogation scene where he's rubbing fingerprint. What is it? Fingerprint stuff on his face.
All over the wall.
Yeah, he puts blackface on himself for no good reason.
Which was like improvised, which is even crazier that it's like, this is what I'll do in this scene. Like, all right.
The cop just keeps asking if he's gay. He's like, oh,
yeah, he's just like giving this smart ass answer to everything. And you just love this character.
Yeah.
And so once he's released from jail, he finds out that, well, Terry Lennox is dead.
Yes.
And,
case closed.
Case closed. We're going to close the books on this. No questions asked.
Right.
And so he is out to clear his friend's good name when Eileen Wade, played by Nina Van Pallant, comes to him in search of her husband, played by the great Sterling Hayden.
Yes.
Her husband's Roger Wade. He's a novelist, and he has gone missing. He does this time to time. He's a drunk.
He's basically Ernest Hemingway, even the way he looks.
Yeah, and this is definitely... kind of paid homage to by Paul Thomas Anderson. Is that Eric Roberts who plays the character that just played?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So,
Mickey Wolfman.
Yeah, Mickey Wolfman in Inherent Vice also checks himself into a nut house, as does this Roger Wade, and that's where Philip Marlowe finds him.
But not only that, this goes back to the Pynchon novel where like these two events that are supposed to be unrelated are somehow connected to each other.
That's like an old noir trope. Every time, like all those Raymond Chandler books, he's always taking on two cases, and at the end, like they're always connected. That's like a standard thing.
Okay.
Right, and that plays into Altman's deconstructing the noir genre in general with this right. with this trope being used, except instead of being a rainy New York sidewalk scene, this yeah. is in sunny L.A.
Yeah.
This movie could not be brighter and sunnier, which is also another Inherent Vice aping, but so yeah, he goes, he finds Wade in the nut house talking to this doctor played by Martin Short. Oh, I'm sorry. played by Mark Rydell or Henry Gibson.
Right. Who was in Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia.
He certainly was, as the worst character in the film.
I like that character, the weird old gay man.
Yeah.
I like this scene because he keeps walking up to people at the nut house and they keep shushing him every time he has them.
It's so bizarre. Like, it makes you feel crazy
watching it. Wait, that's the guy in Magnolia, the gay guy at the bar? Yeah. Oh, he's great in that. I liked him.
See, it's like this nut house, it's like, I don't even think it's like a reputable nut house because he's clearly...
Oh, it's shady.
He's clearly bilking this character. What the hell is that guy? Sterling Hayden's name? Roger Wade. He owes it. You owe me money, and like, what doctor goes around doing that?
It kind of reminds me of like the way rehabs are now in California.
You have to pay up front.
Yeah. The like really expensive
your parents
ones.
Haven't paid for your heroin rehabilitation, so you have to leave.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for the help.
Yeah.
So yeah, this doctor, Dr. Verringer, played by Henry Gibson, he is also referred to as Dr. Derringer and Dr. Berringer and several other things. And that's another thing. Marlowe is referred to by Roger Wade as Marlboro and several other things. And there's a lot of aliases being used in this film, which I found interesting. And I don't know if that
he kept calling him Jeff Rollins. I was like, well,
nope,
that's weird.
That's incorrect. That's my name, Dave.
Oh.
And I wasn't born at this time.
That would be crazy.
This film came out 10 whole years before I was born. So, now that we're off track,
sorry.
There's a lot of aliases used in this film, and I have to think that that was intentional.
Yeah, I would say so.
Being a detective story. I just found that interesting as an aside. But so, yeah, he breaks Wade out of the nut house, takes him back home to his wife, and that's when things start getting really bizarre because it involves money being owed to this gangster named Marty Augustine, played by Mark Rydell, who Terry Lennox owed this man, was it $350,000 that he apparently had stolen?
Yeah, in a bowling bag.
Yeah.
Right.
And so now this Marty Augustine wants Philip Marlowe to pay him back for his friend's his debts now that he's dead or disappeared or whatever he is. And so that is the whole middle act of the film.
Right. And I really liked Mark Rydell's performance. I love that this character is – he's amusing and then he's suddenly terrifying. Like, I love the way they played that.
You're terrified whenever he's in frame because this man is a madman.
Right.
He's menacing and he's a loose cannon. Just to make a point of how crazy he is, he calls up his girlfriend. His girlfriend knocks on the door where he's discussing business with Philip Marlowe, interrupting.
Right.
He tells her to come in. He asks her, what would you like? She said, I want a Coke. And they're in Marlowe's apartment. And Marlowe says, I have a Coke in the refrigerator. So he goes, gets her a Coke, and then breaks it over her face, scarring her and breaking her teeth, apparently, because she's wearing braces later in the film.
It's like, those fucking Coke bottles are hard as hell. Could you imagine how – like, it would be impossible to break that on someone's face.
The way that scene is done is just fantastic because
the tension is
building.
You
can tell something's going to happen, and you don't really know what. And it just happens, and it's really disturbing.
Yeah, Altman did a great job of somehow – through the subtext, letting you know this isn't good.
Right.
This isn't good.
Right.
But you have no idea. Like, is it not good for Marlowe? Is it not good for Marty Augustine? Who is this not good for? And the least suspecting person gets a Coke bottle smashed over her face. It's insane. What do you think of that?
The Coke scene? Yeah. I saw it coming, but I don't know why. That is interesting. I wish I could go back and watch it right now to see what's done to telegraph it, but I think that it's almost referenced in film that happens after it, and that's why, because we were used to that like gangster being nice until that second where he's not.
He's this very cordial he's like a big personality. He doesn't seem, you know, you never see him hurt anybody prior to that,
yeah,
But and then the fact that the first time you see him hurt somebody is, in his words, that's someone I love.
Right.
I don't love you. So it's horrifying, really.
The movie has, and I guess this is just like an Altman thing he loves to do, because even McCabe and Mrs. Miller has it. It just has all these really interesting, I guess you call them quirky characters. Yeah. Like even this character, I would call quirky.
Yeah, he keeps taking his shirt off.
He even tells Marlo, "Go ahead, touch my stomach. It's rock hard."
And then there's like the security guard who's always doing impressions. It's just these little neat little things. Like these could easily be just like throwaway characters, but he gives them all little ticks.
Everybody has a reason for being there.
Right.
There's no throwaway characters.
But then I would say this is where it breaks from the noir tradition and starts to get more Inherent Vice-y, is where now this guy is also connected to Hayden.
Right.
To Sterling Hayden's character.
Right.
And so now you have three different cases that are all connected to each other.
For me, it's still up into the air whether this Marty Augustine owed money to Roger Wade, or if Roger Wade owed money to him. Yeah, I still don't know.
Yeah, because you get two different versions of the story.
And that it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't. And again, that's same thing with Inherent Vice, where it does, like the mystery really doesn't matter.
But I feel like after this scene, the movie starts to sag a little bit.
Really?
Like I wasn't...
Well,
that second to third act, I wasn't too on board.
Well, yeah, from here on out, Eileen Wade sort of, I guess you could say, sort of romances Marlo, where she's making him dinner, and I don't say he's falling for her, he's just like, he's happy to be around her, basically, because he doesn't, I guess you could say he's sort of lonely, he doesn't have anyone.
He got his cat.
And the cat, after the first scene, the cat never comes back, the cat's gone the rest of the movie, and so she just wants him to be around, because her husband, he's just crazy, which is evident. There's a great scene where Marlo and Sterling Hayden, they have this conversation that's just really about nothing. He's just like rambling on and on.
He's a lunatic.
Yeah.
And he's a wife beater.
Yes.
And there's a lot of misogyny like that in this film. He beats his wife. Marty Augustine smashes a Coke bottle.
Right.
And I don't know. There was something about the misogyny that kind of bugged me, but you know.
I'm right there with you. It was like, but it was almost like, too normalized.
That's what it was. You just articulated exactly what it was about. It's just like, oh, this is how
it
is.
It's not a big deal. Yeah.
But I also feel like the only characters who are like that are like the negative characters. Marlo isn't that way. I mean, so.
Right. Yeah, Marlo is the, you know, he's the moral compass. Right. Except for the end.
Yes. So So what did you think of the Eileen Wade character? Because I actually did not like this performance.
No,
she's not an actress.
Yeah,
I think that's why I didn't like this portion of the film, because it focuses too much on her.
She's not an actress. At the same time, though, I liked that I didn't catch on that she was basically playing Marlo the entire film. Like I didn't really pick up on that. And I don't know if that's because her performance wasn't good enough or just it was such a well-written character. I don't know.
Yeah. So as it turns out, Roger Wade kills himself, really. He drowns in the ocean.
Walks out into the ocean after
a bender. And
gives himself to the sea.
Yeah. And that basically solves everyone's problems. What's her name? Eileen?
Yeah.
Now that her husband's out of the picture, she can go live with Terry Lennox, who, surprise, is still alive and living in South America.
Yeah, well, Marlo thinks something's fishy from just everything going on. He thinks Roger Wade killed Terry Lennox's wife, because he's still holding out hope that Terry Lennox is a great guy.
Yeah, that's his friend.
Right, and there's a funny scene where like the cops are there, and he's drunk, and he's like, oh, Roger Wade was having an affair, and they were like, we fucking know. And he just walks away, and he's just like, and that's the one time the mumbling work, where he's walking away and he's drunkenly mumbling. He's like, you motherfuckers, which you don't really hear in movies from the 70s. You don't hear the phrase motherfuckers.
Not so until
like,
the 80s do you hear that.
That shocked me that was in this film. So I like that.
Fatherfuckers, that's what they
say. Yes. And then from there, he meets with Marty Augustine again, and this is the Arnold Schwarzenegger scene.
Yes.
So
I want to pump you up. That's what he says.
He says nothing. He doesn't have one line in the film.
He does flex his pectorals, though. Mm. They go up and down.
I feel like that was the whole reason they all got undressed, because they wanted an excuse to have Arnold Schwarzenegger show off his muscles.
There's a very good chance.
Yeah, because this was his...
this character was not in the novel.
Yeah, this is... And this was
the Marty Augustine character, I mean. He's not in the novel at all.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's character was in the novel,
yes,
though.
He certainly was.
He was called Arnold Schwarzenegger with mustache.
In parentheses.
He played John Kimball. He was a kindergarten cop. So, yeah. Marlo meets with Augustine again, and somewhere in the middle of this,
I just wanted to. I love that Marty Augustine's gang. They were all were different, like creed. There was like a Hispanic guy, an Italian guy. They were all like he had like it was like the League of Nations,
and they make note of that.
Yeah.
Marla goes to meet with Augustine, and in the middle of this meeting, telling him, "I don't have your money," the money shows up.
Yeah.
Surprise!
Yeah.
And
which I thought was some Deus Ex Machina at first. I was what is happening here?
And then you realize that, oh, wait, Mrs. Wade was in cahoots, and she doesn't need that money anymore. Because
And also, Marla has a $5,000 bill in his wallet, which I was like, what is this?
Yeah, yeah, and they make note of that in the film. How many were made in the entire United States?
I think it says like four. It's like a really little number. It's some insane.
I can't remember. So we get to see a $5,000 bill with President Dan Quayle on it, I believe. The money turns up, so Marlowe's off the hook from Marty Augustine.
And he goes outside, and he sees Mrs. Wade in the car, and he says, Hey, Mrs. Wade!
And he says it for 23 minutes.
Mrs. Wade!
Yeah, there's a on-foot chase scene where he runs after her car for approximately 7 hours, yelling, Hey, Mrs. Wade!
Which this Inherent Vice also tips its hat to this at the very end when, I forget her name, but the
Catherine Watterson?
Yeah, Catherine Watterson's character is driving away, and Doc is running after the car.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even pick up on that.
It's just a slight thing, nice. But it's there. And so she drives off after Marlo chases her on foot, and he thinks, she definitely heard me because she was in a convertible, and I was yelling.
And then a car hits him in a really poorly done scene where basically Altman, I guess just to make it as cheap as possible, he literally moves the camera away and then moves it back, and Marlo's just laying on a car.
You hit me with your car.
It's really poorly done.
Yeah. And so he wakes up next to the mummy from the mummy films.
Oh, yeah. And then there's terrible exposition, just like earlier where he says, I'm a private eye. He wakes up and goes, oh, yeah, I got hit by a car. Like, why is he saying
it? We knew that. We just saw it happen.
Did you see the license plate on her car said, love you?
Yes.
As he was pulling away?
Yeah. Yep.
Like that touch.
And then, and there's I love that even the mummy has a weird quirk where he just has the world's tiniest harmonica, which it's almost like that belongs in like a parody film. Like, why is that happening?
Yeah.
I like that whole scene. It's like, oh, Philip, the nurse comes in. She's like, Philip Marlowe, you shouldn't be out of the bed.
He's like, I'm not Philip.
He's Philip Marlowe.
And he said, don't worry, you'll be all right. I've loved all your pictures too. You know, referencing the fact that he looks like the mummy.
Yeah.
And I wanted to touch on that. He has the world's tiniest harmonica in which he starts playing the theme to this film.
Yes. Oh yeah. We haven't mentioned that. So
we have to mention that because there's only there's two songs in the whole film. One is Hooray for Hollywood, which is done as kind of a thumbing the nose to the old Hollywood studio system, I feel, because it's such a degraded recording of Hooray for Hollywood. And then the other song, which is played, I have to think, at least 15 times in 15 different ways, is the Long Goodbye theme.
Right.
And it's a recurring piece of music written by John Williams that is played in so many different styles of music. There's there's a funeral procession, Mexican funeral procession that plays it. The supermarket where he's going to buy his cat food, it's played as Muzak, sort of like elevator music. The harmonica that the mummy man plays.
Yeah.
It's like jazz.
There's
a
jazz club where it's playing in the background. There's a guy noodling on a guitar, just like certain parts of the song. And I loved this.
I don't like the song, but I love the concept. I love that it's such an interesting.
Well, the song is corny.
Yeah.
And the song is really, really corny.
But it's such an interesting quirk. I don't think I've ever seen a film that has done something like that, where they only use one song but done different ways. It's just like a neat touch.
It is. And it's sort of like instead of the overlapping dialogue, this is his version of doing that because this is playing as people are talking, and it's the same piece of music.
And it's just, I love that anytime someone turns on a radio, this is the song playing. And even in the beginning intro, when Marlo is muttering to himself, he actually mutters lines from the song. So it's like he's hearing the film soundtrack somehow.
Yeah,
it's sort of like breaking the fourth wall.
I love
it. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it does have like a weird haunting effect almost.
It is. It makes the film sort of like isolated. It's just like, this song is just everywhere. It's like the song haunts the film, basically. Yeah.
And another and it's a theme. It's the film's theme, and it's played throughout in different ways, and, right. and it's a versatile theme. But another, I think, a major theme that's kind of like not at the forefront is the fact that there are so many dogs in this movie barking right. at Marlowe and at each other. And there's even a scene where two dogs bark at each other and then one starts humping the other one. But
yeah, there's a lot of dogs in Mexico, too,
yeah.
when he goes there. Yeah.
But the opening of the film is Marlowe trying to feed his cat. Mm. And I think that's intentional because I think it's meant to position Marlowe as a cat in a doggy dog world. And every one of these other characters, they're so there's an evilness to them.
Right.
Whereas Marlowe he's clean, he's good. And they're meant to be dogs, and he's meant to be a cat, and that's why, like, he's even referred to as Mr. Katz by those realtor ladies. I can't even imagine that's unintentional.
I didn't even pick up on that.
That's intentional.
That's cool.
And that is just another one of those Altman, you know, Altmanisms, we'll call them.
Yes.
Altruistic things.
Nope. I like mine better.
Yeah.
Just these technical touches and thematic touches that really make this film something special.
Yeah.
Overall, I really like the movie.
It's a beautiful movie.
I liked this more than McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah, I did definitely. Too.
And McCabe and Mrs. Miller is considered Altman's like masterpiece, but I think this is a better film.
This movie's just cool. It is. There's like a coolness to it.
Yeah.
Now I feel cooler having seen it.
Like so, I said, like it makes me want to like just put on a suit and smoke cigarettes for like 48 yeah. hours
and just stumble around.
Yeah,
and
just be stumble
like, okay,
around.
Whatever. I'll give you a ride.
So, all right. So what do we think?
We've talked about the ending. So right. let's talk about the ending.
Yeah. So what does everyone think of this ending where he goes to Tijuana and Marty August, what's the character's name?
Terry Lennox.
Terry Lennox he's just in a hammock. He's living it up.
He's having a mojito.
Well, yeah. Marlo, I keep wanting to call him Altman, but Marlo goes to Tijuana and he drives around with the authorities and he bribes them with a $5,000 bill.
Yeah.
I think James Madison is on it. And,
he's in search of the truth, yeah, just like Doc Spertello was.
And Marlowe, by this point, has figured out that Terry Lennox is still alive and he really did kill his wife, and that Terry Lennox has been having an affair with Eileen, who earlier she said her husband was having the affair with
Lennox's wife.
And he killed Lennox's wife, which is clearly not what happened. Yeah. So Marlowe goes to Tijuana, he finds Terry Lennox, and Terry Lennox says, you know, he's like, oh, I'm glad to see you. But then he says, like, you're a born loser.
Yeah.
And Marlowe says, yeah, I even lost my cat, and then shoots him to death.
Which was shocking.
Right.
Because this whole time you're thinking, this character, he's the clean one.
He's so passive.
Which is it's like another scene where someone in an Altman movie gets shot and falls into water.
Yeah.
Too. It mimics that scene.
And up until this point, Marlowe is such a passive character. He doesn't.
This is the first time that he actually takes his own destiny into his hands and makes a decision that affects the rest of the movie.
Where,
I mean, this is the end of the movie, but you know, he does that great scene where he kisses the woman on the way out.
Yeah, and then is that her? Eileen driving.
Yeah, that's her driving up to meet, and she sees him,
and she knows. Well, this isn't good,
and. And this is the book does not end like this. He does not kill Terry Lennox.
How does the book end? Does it just end?
He finds out the truth, basically.
Finds out the truth, but he doesn't do anything about it.
Right.
And the screenwriter that adapted the novel changed that.
Right.
I think it's better for that.
It's a great sort of way of just showing that even Marlowe isn't like above all of this. He sort of has to like lower himself to meet
out justice,
right?
Because he does deliver justice.
Yeah,
because
you want something to happen.
Sort of like it's forcing his character to finally be in the present. He's no longer like in the 50s.
That's
anymore.
A great way to put it.
Like he's forced to come into the 70s and kill someone. Because it's sort of like that, you know, if he were a time traveler, there's that thing in time travel movies where you can't do anything; it'll affect. You know, the continuum, and he finally is just forced to do something.
Right, and the effect is, it like you said, it yanks him into the now,
right.
rather than being stuck in the 50s. And speaking about that, the fact that this is such a teardown of 50s noir,
right.
and, you know, like I said, the Hollywood studio systems, the fact that Altman used, what's his name, Sterling Hayden?
Right.
who was a blacklisted actor. He was one of the people that ratted out. He was a communist, and he ratted out
Pinko.
He was an actual communist who ratted out fellow actors to the Un-American Activities Committee in the 50s. And he said that was the most shameful thing he's ever done in his life. He had complete remorse, but he was blacklisted by Hollywood.
He was kind of like forced through McCarthyism to rat out other
actors.
Like
most people were. It's not like he was a bad person. It's just like he could either testify or go to jail.
Yeah. And so he was blacklisted, and the fact that he was chosen by Altman to appear in this is such a middle finger to Hollywood itself. Yeah. But also the casting of Jim Bouton as Terry Lennox. He was a retired baseball player who wrote the very first tell-all book about baseball, where he named names, kind of like Jose Canseco did recently.
So it's like a fuck you to America industry
pretty
in general.
Much. Yeah. American ideals, old Hollywood, baseball, and also Nina Van Pallant, who played Eileen Wade, she was the mistress of Clifford Irving, who wrote the fake biography of Howard Hughes, where he made up everything, and Howard Hughes is an American icon.
Yeah.
Right.
So just Altman's use of these kind of iconoclastic people is really telling about what his motivations were in making this film and what his feelings were about Hollywood at the time. Even though he came to represent, you know, new Hollywood in the 70s, now that we're looking back with 2020 hindsight,
right.
It's just interesting.
Yeah, and even the Hemingway addition to it, which like the machoism and the rugged individualism of American life, mm-hmm. like that is mocked in this too. As just drunk.
It's a man that drinks himself to death by drowning in the ocean.
Yes,
as his dog is flipping out on the coast.
That's cool, and like that's where the themes of this and Inherent Vice like kind of triangulate. They mm-hmm. they come together.
Yeah, there's a big theme in Inherent Vice where these characters in the 70s are nostalgic for like the free love of the 60s.
Right.
And in that, like one of those Joanna Newsom voiceovers, it's saying like maybe that just wasn't real to begin with. Maybe it's just like it's all just manufactured and by corporations.
Yeah, it's an updated version of this film, which is saying, you know, maybe the good old days, they weren't so good to begin with.
Right.
I mean, everybody was drinking nonstop.
Yeah.
But Altman makes a California you don't really want to be a part of.
No,
whereas
it's seedy.
Inherent Vice was like, oh, I want to live there.
Inherent Vice, California is this madhouse.
Right.
It's a metaphorical madhouse of crazy characters, whereas this is just dangerous people and people that'll stab you in the back in a heartbeat.
It's a very cool movie.
It was great.
I really liked it. I liked it more than I even thought I was going
so
to.
So did I. I kind of thought I was going to like it because I like Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
I liked him a lot, even though he had a bit part in American History X. I liked his character. I could have used an entire film about that character. He plays the mother's Jewish boyfriend.
Yeah, I want to actually just go start seeking out like older Elliot Gould films after watching this because he was just so good in this.
And he's been in a lot.
Yeah, I'm looking at his filmography now. There's a lot of stuff.
But I don't think anything's going to match how iconic this role is.
I mean, I wanted to point this out too. I was reading this thing where Elliot Gould said as long as he's physically able, he's always wanted to play Philip Marlowe again.
That would be amazing.
And he bought the rights to another Philip Marlowe book. I forget which one it is. And he's been waiting since the 70s for someone to come along and make this movie. I just wish someone would do that right now before he gets too old. Because I would love to see like Elliot Gould now playing this character.
Yeah,
like in the modern era, that would be amazing.
The hell's Paul Thomas Anderson waiting for?
I know.
Let's go.
I wish that.
I'd even take a David Fincher.
Just anyone.
I'd take a David Duchovny movie if he's directing it.
No.
Whew. Okay, so
let's.
Awesome.
What
I
I'm
like
saying
that.
Is, let's start a Kickstarter for Elliot Gould.
Yeah,
I like it. Yeah, let's get.
We
this
only
thing
need
off the
$9
ground.
million. So
yeah, that's our discussion on The Long Goodbye,
which
was a fantastic film, and you should seek it out. Buy it on iTunes. Buy it wherever you buy videos.
Yeah, it was on Netflix Instant for the longest time, and then, of course, when we went to watch it, when I went to watch it, it wasn't there anymore. So
check the red box. It might be in there.
So
it might be. You never know.
No, it's not in there. Don't even waste your gas. Next week, we're going to be talking about 1985's Fool for Love. I say that we're going to be talking about that next week, assuming that no great films come out where we discuss that instead, because it is going to be the first weekend in February, and there's nothing good coming out.
Well, Jupiter Ascending comes out this week.
So we'll be talking about Fool for Love next week.
Which that actually looks so batshit crazy that I'm starting to become interested in it.
I am too.
That's Channing Tatum with elf ears, correct?
But Fool for Love, I'm a little nervous about Fool for Love because I was reading just like, not reviews, but just like comments on it. And mm-hmm. someone said, I'm a Robert Altman lover. And even for me, this movie is terrible. Uh-oh. So I'm a little nervous.
Well, as usual, my pick will be the worst in the series.
Good work, Jeff.
In case you forgot, I picked David Cronenberg's Existenz earlier or at the end of last year. And that didn't turn out good for anyone.
Jeff hates us.
I do. I truly do. So, yeah. Next week, we'll be talking about Fool for Love, which came out in 1985. But
you know what I'm a fool for? Movie recommendations.
Are you really?
Now, how was that for a segue? Was that good?
That was pretty good.
A little better than Dave's.
Let me play this. My eyes just bugged out of my head.
That voice. Ooh. What is that? And it's not even an attempt to be in time with the music. Just
listen.
You could have easily timed it, but no.
There was really no reason for that to be 17 seconds. That could have been like a 5 second one, really.
Saying picking for a full like 30 beats. Picking.
Listen, you're going to want to go back and listen to that again.
Whew.
Okay.
Make it your ringtone.
They just keep getting better every week.
They really do. We exceed all expectations.
Because I've been in the lab with a pen and a pad.
Mm. That was my Dr. Dre impression.
I didn't like it.
Maybe I'll do that next week.
Please don't.
All right. So who wants to go first here?
I'll go. I don't think I go first a lot, so I'll go. So in keeping with the shambly detective theme, I'm going to pick 1998's Zero Effect, a film that very few people saw. And it stars Bill Pullman and Ben Stiller, and it's directed by Jake Kasdan, who is Lawrence Kasdan's son. And this film is basically it's a playoff of Sherlock Holmes, where Bill Pullman is this sort of eccentric, almost autistic asshole detective who's like a loner, and he just keeps to himself, but he's represented by his assistant, who's played by Ben Stiller, sort of playing like the Dr. Watson character. And Ryan O'Neal is in this film too, star of Barry Lyndon.
Right. It's the triptych.
Yeah,
Ryan O'Neal.
And so Bill Pullman, he's his character. His name is Daryl Zero, and he's like the world's greatest private
Irish fella.
Yeah, he's the world's greatest private detective, but he's just so eccentric that very few people can get near him. And Ryan O'Neal plays a millionaire who hires him to find his missing car keys, and from there. Crazy stuff happened. It's just a really eccentric, interesting film. It's a small sort of character film, and it's funny. It's really well done. Bill Pullman is really good in this, and very few people saw it when it came out, but it sort of has like a cult following now. So if you could find it, I'd recommend it. 1998's Zero Effect.
It doesn't look good from the box art.
It's really shitty box art, but it's...
Well, mid-90s were not known for their terrific art on posters.
It was one of those films that it was just so weird and different that they didn't know how to market it. It didn't have, like, mainstream appeal, but it really is worth seeing.
All right, so what was that again? Zero Effect?
Zero Effect from 1998.
Balls, baby, balls!
There it is.
The great Sterling Hayden.
All right, I'll go. My pick this week is for a 1959 movie directed by Robert Bresson called Pickpocket. It stars Martin LaSalle and Marika Green, and it's about a pickpocket, in case you didn't know.
Is this a Criterion film?
It is. Okay. It is available on Hulu Plus, so if you are a subscriber, which I recommend you do.
Is this a Crayola film?
Nope, Criterion. Oh. Different. It's different. This is for adults. It's the synopsis goes like this. Michelle takes up picking pockets as a hobby and is arrested immediately. giving him the chance to reflect on the morality of his crime. After his release, his mother dies and he rejects the support of friends in favor of returning to pickpocketing after taking lessons from an expert because he realizes that it's the only way he can express himself. And This is a it's a short movie. I think it's something like 78 minutes or so. It's black and white. It's French. And what I really like about it is there's a lot of neat scenes where of the actual pickpocketing itself, where
like close-ups.
Yeah, it's all close-ups where like his hand slides into somebody's jacket, picks out the wallet from their inside jacket pocket, drops it, and it shows him catching it. It's just and there's this wonderful set piece where it's after he Michel joins this group. It's three of them. They head to this train, and it's just this elaborate heist where they steal from everybody in the train, and they're like handing things off to one another.
Is it done like zanily, or is it dead serious?
It's dead serious, which makes it even funnier, and you can really appreciate it. Like, it's not meant to be funny, and it is sometimes just at the absurdity of like when he steals people's watches. It's almost as though. Like, come on. Are you kidding me? Right. He's taking this guy's watch off without him realizing it. But then they show him practicing the watch trick at home where he has it wrapped around a table leg.
Oh, cool.
And he goes and grabs somebody's hand that way at the exact same angle. It's a really cool movie.
That sounds cool.
And yeah. it's in you know, theme with the noir.
Is it in color?
No, it's black and white. Your eyes don't work in black and white.
Does it have subtitles?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a double whammy.
You have to know French to enjoy this movie. No, they're subtitles, and they're good. And the other interesting thing about it is it's almost entirely done with narration. Like, the story is told with narration.
I'm looking it up. It says it's only 75 minutes long. It's very brief.
It's incredibly brief.
Which I'm not saying is a bad thing, because, man, movies are too long these days.
This tells a really good story. There's good characterization. There's good motivations for these characters. You believe everything that they're doing. There's really no reason for this guy not to be a pickpocket once he explains himself. It's a good movie.
Nice.
In 1959's Pickpocket, directed by Robert Bresson.
Balls, baby, balls!
It's weird there's just like a beat under that. Like it's a club song is about to begin.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. It might be him punching his wife. I don't know, knowing that movie.
I think I hear a song starting. Hooray for Gabriel!
Balls, baby, balls!
Yeah, it sounds like it's from like a 90s computer program.
It's ripped right from the film.
Yeah. Okay, my pick for the week... My pick and movies is Breach from 2007.
Oh, nice.
I think we've mentioned this film before on the podcast.
I recommended Shattered Glass, which is from the same director.
Oh, okay. Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yes.
No, his name's just Billy Ray. This is based on a true story about a FBI cadet who becomes like, I guess like an assistant, is it?
Yeah, sort of.
Like almost, I guess like a partner, but he's, what's that fucking word? Like a trainee almost?
Yeah, yeah.
Consultant?
No, he's like the underling of a guy who's been at the FBI for a long time. Like he's assigned to
this
him.
This is the one with Chris Cooper, right?
Yeah
Chris Cooper plays Robert Hansen, this FBI agent who was like so perfect and like, and loved like on the outside, but it turned out he had been selling secrets to the Soviets the entire time he was in the FBI or the CIA. I don't know.
I think it's CIA.
Yeah, he's in the CIA. The other guy's in the... He starts out in the FBI, and they send him over to the CIA like as his first mission to like get in with this guy, who's played by Ryan Phillippe. And this movie is fucking nerve-wracking.
It is.
It is very hard to watch at times because... That guy who Chris Cooper plays is kind of a psychopath.
Yeah, he's really religious. He's like super religious.
Chris Cooper is good at playing that slightly restrained lunatic.
Yeah.
He's that you know is about to explode. And I love Chris Cooper. He's one of my favorite actors.
He's really great.
But he also plays like the kind of person who would notice like if their pen was slightly moved on their desk.
It's like obsessive.
So Ryan Phillippe has to keep going into his office and like... bugging it and stuff in ways that Chris Cooper won't know. And Ryan Phillippe, who I'm not crazy about at all, is actually pretty good in this.
Yeah, he was good in this, yeah. I'm not a big Ryan Phillippe fan, but he was good in this.
So that's 2 weeks in a row that I'm going on espionage, anti-government.
Are you selling
movies?
Our secrets? Dave's selling all the Cutprint film secrets. I don't like to eat the crust on my sandwiches.
I'm selling them printed on mugs on Zazzle.com.
Secret two is we're very poor.
Yes. Well, yeah, there's no money in the coffers, but there's plenty of money in the coffin.
Life insurance money. That's what he's getting at.
Just cut that right off. Nip it in the bud.
All right, so that's our show.
Go to Twitter. Go to Facebook. Find us on YouTube.
Yes, yeah. Do all that. Yeah. We're at cutprintfilm.com. That's where you can find all our great movie reviews, editorials, interviews, and essays. Also, this very podcast.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher.
Or YouTube, although it hasn't been updated with the podcast in a while.
But it usually is.
Yeah.
And give us a glowing review. Tell us how much you like our content, how much you like our in-depth movie reviews and discussions.
And as we said last week, if you have a suggestion for the director series, just shoot us an email.
Yeah, we're all ears. Yeah. Literally, we're three ears with legs and hands.
It's really disturbing.
It's disgusting, really. So, yeah, next week on cutprintfilm.com, here's what you can expect. We have reviews for Jupiter Ascending, which will probably not be a good movie. We have a review for The Seventh Son, which will definitely not be a good movie.
No.
Also, Ballet 422 is an indie movie coming out in limited release. We also have Love, Rosie, Outcast, which is the new Nicolas Cage
Chinese
movie. I guess it's his pool payment.
Well, yeah. The Voices, which is a Ryan Reynolds film that debuted at Sundance a year ago and then sat on a shelf for a year.
How are Reynolds' abs in the film?
They don't get a lot of play in the film, I must say.
You can bounce a quarter off those bad boys.
Check us out on Twitter where you can see me tweeting awesome tweets like, hey, at Vinny Chase, I'm so excited for the new movie.
Yeah. You can also find us on Facebook and like our page, won't you?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
No. Facebook's utterly worthless, but why not like us?
Yeah. And then you should also listen to Joystick Jerks, Anti-Fanboy. Those are some other podcasts and websites. They're great. Listen to them.
Also, check out morelikeradio.com. There's 1,000,003 podcasts available for download on their station.
Also, I haven't plugged it in a while. I have a book called The House on Creep Street. Go to Amazon and look it up. It's a scary book about Halloween.
Are there any dirty pictures?
You'll have to buy the book to find out, Jeff.
That's a good selling tactic. I'll have to buy six just to be sure.
My work here is done.
All right, guys, we got to pack up and get out of here because there's a rock block coming up after this.
Oh, God. I don't even know what that means. Is Dwayne Johnson coming in?
No, it's like a block of rock music that they play on this channel.
Oh, on the podcast channel?
Yeah. Will they play the Black Crowes? I love blues rock. It's good.
What about Buck Cherry? Is there any Buck Cherry?
How about Chuck Berry?
Wait. Oh, that's cool. Buck Cherry, yeah, Chuck Berry.
This one actually works. I hope he plays My Ding-a-ling.
Lemons.